Hello and welcome to the Face of Pro-Life. Today I'm very pleased to be speaking with Dr. Lorraine Hartnett. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And we're going to talk a little bit about her medical evolution, her journey through her getting her degree and coming to where she's practicing in the ER, as well as her faith journey and how she's become the whole physician that she has become today. So tell us a little bit about where you went to medical school and, you know, where you went from there.
Well, I went to medical school at NYU Medical School, but that was after a long journey with the church and without the church, if you know what I mean. I was raised as a good Catholic girl in the 50s. I'll be 56 in 2 weeks, so I was born in the 50s, and that was a good time to be born a Catholic. I was born into a beautiful Catholic family, which was I was surrounded by Catholicism. Let's put it that way, in visually and spiritually and in every way, by example. So that's when I learned what I needed to know. From the time
in your formative years.
Yes, in my formative years. My grandmother was just the most wonderful teacher. She taught by example. You know, like St. Francis said, teach the gospel, and if you have to, say a few words. Florence didn't say too many words, but boy, did she teach the gospel. Anyone who was sick came to her house. If there was someone in the hospital, she went to visit. She was you know, a person who lived the works of mercy. Yes, the faith. My grandfather passed the basket, and I would be going to church with them all the time and just really learned everything right. I had great nuns teaching me in school. I always went to Catholic school, and I had fantastic teachers. When people talk about Catholic education negatively, I never know what they're talking about because I went through 12 years and I had the most selfless, wonderful, holy women teaching me and wonderful priests teaching me. So I had a great, great formation as a Catholic. I was in the choir. That was my first group that I joined in the church. And I just loved singing those holy hymns in Latin. I loved it. As a little child, I'd be seven years old, and in that choir singing Tantum Ergo. And I can still remember, now that I sing, I can still remember being there. So I was really raised then. And I know why, you know, God gave me such a great upbringing, because he had a plan for me.
You needed that foundation.
Yes. And I didn't really understand what the plan was, and I fought the plan.
I think we all
really
that.
Fought the plan. But I always believed. My faith was never shaken, no matter what stupid things I've done in my life. My faith was never shaken. I knew I wanted to be a doctor from the age of six.
Wow.
My mother was very depressed when I was growing up. And so I lived with a depressed mother, who sometimes was there and sometimes wasn't, emotionally and every other way. So I learned to be somewhat self-reliant, but also to rely on the women in my family. I had, she had two sisters and her mother. So they were all kind of my surrogate mothers when I needed it. And not to say that my mother wasn't loving, she was, and I loved her so much. And she had everything to do with my final conversion to come back to the faith, which is all just, that's the story. But these other women in my life really were there for me. They taught me, they took care of me, and they showed me. So my aunt Beverly worked in a hospital. She started working when she was 14. She quit high school and started emptying bedpans and, you know, doing all those things around the ward. And she would take me to work with her. And this was at the Rhode Island Hospital. I was born in Rhode Island. And the first time I went to, this is a funny little story. The first time I went to the hospital, I was 2 years old. And they used to dress me up in these cute little outfits because I was the oldest grandchild. So I got all this attention. And they took, I remember her taking me into the front door of the Rhode Island Hospital, and there was a big set of stairs, these big swirly stairs. And the minute I went in, the smell of the hospital
No.
struck me. And at that time, hospitals smelled of ether and all kinds of weird things, which they don't now. I don't know what happened to that, but they smell pretty good now.
Yeah, they've
But
added
then,
lemon to
then it
clean
just
salt.
struck me, and I threw up all over the floor. That was my first minute in a hospital. So I guess that was the little enemy's way of getting me out. But instead, I just loved that hospital environment. I loved the what they were doing there. I loved taking care of people. I loved the social aspect. It was like another family.
Sure.
So I guess that kind of fit in. And I just knew by the time I was six, I wanted to be a doctor.
Wow.
I knew I was always smart in school, and I knew that was the way to get accepted. That was pretty quick that the Lord taught me that you do well in school, people really like you, you know. So I did really well in school, and everybody would pat me on the head,
overachiever.
an overachiever. But I loved learning. I always loved learning. It was never hard for me.
Right.
I always say to people who have a lot of trouble, hey, I didn't have any trouble. I loved studying, and it was easy for me. If it was as hard as it is for you, maybe I wouldn't have done it.
Right.
So I always encourage people who are having trouble, because for me it was easy. I admit it. And I knew I wanted to be a doctor.
Well, you had goals, and it's always
I
nice,
did.
easy to
I did. And
easier to strive.
my father, who was a real man in the family, and went out and worked every day, and never saw him take a day off. He, when I said I thought I wanted to be a doctor, he said, and this was in 1958, he said to me, "You can do whatever you want to do. If
Wow.
you want to be a doctor, then you go and study to be a doctor." And that was a big deal in those days,
Absolutely.
because women didn't do that kind of
Right.
stuff. Women
And
all,
certainly the men weren't supporting them.
right, and all the women I knew were staying home taking care of babies, which was, to me, the best profession.
Right.
But I had to take second best because, being a doctor really is a great profession. So I went along in school, and I loved school. I loved my faith. I loved God. I lived in this environment which was filled with, everybody was always saying their rosary. Grandma always had a rosary in her hand, always. And I followed suit. And I went to high school in New York. My father was transferred to New York City. And that was kind of the beginning of everything for me, the beginning of the end. It could have been the end, the beginning of my kind of counter conversion, as you might say, my unwinding. So I went to high school in New York City, and of course, I was exposed to many, many things
Yeah.
that I had never been exposed
Now,
to.
as you're being exposed, were you taken away from your grandmother and
Yes,
your
I
aunts
was.
that were your system, your
Yes.
sister?
So when you're taken out of your comfort zone, you don't have your support system, and that's when everything started changing for me, very subtly. So that first year in eighth grade, I cried every day. I remember my mother picking me up from school, and I would go in my room and cry. And I was of course 12, 13. I was just 13. In
It's a
fact, we had
hard
just
time.
gone to the Beatles concert.
Oh.
I was 13 years old, and of course that was the time of the Age of Aquarius, the sexual revolution, when everything started to change in the world. And I guess that was that little in where my support system kind of cracked, so let in whatever, all that other stuff from the
Garbage, yeah.
world, all that other garbage. And of course, you're also developing, so that
Right.
at age you're just beginning to develop as an independent person, really. So things started unraveling, and I decided to go to high school in New York City. I didn't want to stay in New Jersey. That's where we were living, right across the George Washington Bridge. I didn't want to stay there anymore. I had bad feelings about the place. I was crying. I just wanted to get out. So they had lovely Catholic schools in New York City, and I guess I was looking to that as another experience, another place. And I took a test and got a scholarship. It was an expensive school, and we didn't have a lot of money at all. I remember really counting the pennies when we moved to New
Literally,
York,
yeah.
because my father had been given a little bit of raise, but not enough to really stand the change in the economics, you know?
Yeah.
So I remember feeling that kind of crunch. And I had gotten a scholarship, went to Mother Cabrini, which was, of course, the shrine of Mother Cabrini. She's buried under the altar. So every day, every morning, we had Mass. And in front of Mother Cabrini. So I've always felt that she was kind of caring for me. And it's I don't think it's an accident that I've become a physician since she founded a lot of hospitals.
Right.
And that I'm kind of doing this work, which has to do with hospitals and education and all of that. She's always been watching out for me. But that was when things started going wrong. I mean, I started going down to discos in the village and, you know, wearing no shoes. If you wore no shoes, you got in free. So I didn't wear shoes.
Still counting the pennies.
Always counting the pennies. We've always had that. You never trust the rich. That was put into me by that Irish Catholic family. You never trust anybody who has money. No. Which isn't exactly true.
Sure.
But anyway, I was in New York City and exposed to everything. You know, drugs and alcohol and sexual stuff. Oh, just everything, and I'm not really going to go into that except to say that I was exposed to everything. And as I began to live longer in New York City, I began to become more of an independent personality and was less controlled by my parents. Mm-hmm. So I sort of learned the ways not to tell the truth, you shall say, which teenagers are apt to do.
So you're not only are you not being controlled by your parents, but you're not being controlled by your faith anymore either.
That's right. And I'm being controlled by the world. And I was very intelligent. I was at the top of the class. I was the editor of the school yearbook. I was, you know, the first one to do any demonstrating, and boy, those nuns didn't like it. Those missionary sisters of the Sacred Heart, they did not like that. They did not like me being such a rebellious type. So when graduation came and I was the salutatorian, there was one really nerdy girl who was ahead of me. She was the valedictorian.
And she wasn't a troublemaker.
But she really liked me. She was my friend. No, she was not a troublemaker at all. She was not a troublemaker. God bless her. She was a wonderful person. And so I was the salutatorian, and I wrote this speech, and it was the time when of Vietnam. So I was very anti-war at that time. And I wrote this speech that really talked a lot about those issues. And I remember the big sister, I forget her name, but she was the teacher who was supervising me, and she would not let me give that speech. She said, "You are not giving that speech, or you're not going to give the speech at all. We are going to write a speech for you, and you will give that." And I said, "Well, I won't give the speech then. To find yourself somebody else. I'm not going to lie." So that was very interesting, because now, as I'm telling you, and I haven't thought about this for years, I've always kind of had this attraction to the truth.
Yeah.
As I've seen it anyway. Now I'm a lot more informed. Then my truth was a little off, but I've always had this, you know, been kind of a rebellious type, and it's in my nature. It's from my background. I come from, my family comes from Ireland, and they were very involved in a lot of that rebellious stuff. So I think I have it in me to be a fighter. And so I told her I wouldn't do anything. I wouldn't give the speech. And then I went home. And I remember telling my mother that I didn't want to give the speech. And my mother was wonderful. She still had her depression, but she was a wonderful mother, really. She was really very loving and was always there for us. You know, always there when you got home. Always there when you needed supervision there. When I was away from her, forget about it. But when she was always there. And I told her, and she was very sad that I wasn't going to give the speech. And she said, "Your grandmother's coming, and your grandfather's coming, and everybody will be so sad if you don't give the speech." So I remember going to my room and really contemplating that.
Laying on the Catholic guilt there.
Yeah, and my mother was good at it, but she wasn't very outward with it. My mother had a very quiet kind of spirituality. She always had all the holy cards in her purse, and she was always saying the rosary, and she had the statue of the Blessed Mother in her bedroom, and she was not beating me over the head with anything. She was very quiet, and a quiet example. But I thought about it, and I said, you know, these people really deserve something. They've given me a lot.
Right.
So I'm not going to disappoint them. And I will give the speech. So I went to school the next day and told the guidance counselor that I would give the speech that they wanted me to give, because I didn't want to disappoint my family. And so I did that. And I gave the speech, and I'll never forget getting up to give the speech. God was going to have fun with me anyway. He knew I didn't want to give that speech. So I remember having a mic around my neck, and I went to the podium and gave the speech, and everybody was kind of snickering because they knew it wasn't the speech that I had written.
Right.
It was a very kind of normal speech, nothing about any of the issues of the day. This was 1970. June of 1970, when we were right in the midst of everything, of the war, of the revolution that was going on in the world, in society. And so this speech was like pablum. It was not what I wanted to say. And everybody was kind of snickering. And I walked away from the podium without taking the mic off. And so it was like I was being strangled by the mic as I walked away. And the whole place just fell down in laughter, which was, it was God's little joke.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
making you humble.
Right. He knew I really didn't want to give this talk. But it was very funny. And then I went on to college. I had gotten a scholarship to NYU.
Wow.
Again, money. We're talking about the money here. Got to count those pennies. But I got a scholarship. At that time, they gave scholarships for academic reasons. They don't so much anymore.
You didn't play football or anything.
I didn't play football, no. And basketball was out of the question. No. I was kind of the mascot. That was about it. But I did play the fife in the marching band.
Yeah, they don't give that many scholarships.
No, I wanted
for band
to play
either.
The glockenspiel, but it was too big for me to carry, so they made me play the fife, which was just this little tin thing. But we were always in the parades, the Columbus Day Parade and the St. Patrick's Day Parade. But I did get an academic scholarship, and this is where my undoing really started getting undone. Oh, yeah. Until that time, I was still going to Mass pretty much every day except Saturday. I mean, at school, and Sunday, there was no question that you went to Mass.
Right.
You didn't have a choice. unless you were like connected to a respirator, you went to Mass. That was it. I mean, there was no choice. There was no choice. It kills me when I take care of people now. Excuse me. When I take care of people who say, oh, he doesn't want to do that. He doesn't want to do this. Whatever it is. I'm like, the kid's 2 years old. What do you mean he doesn't want to do it? You are the parent.
I know.
So the idea of authority, it was always very pronounced
prominent,
in my family. I came from a very military kind of family. So the authority was very clear. And now I see how God put me there to really understand what all of that is about.
Mm-hmm.
And authority is authority, period, end of story. I mean,
it's
I'm a Catholic.
Good. It gives
I
you
obey
guidance
authority.
Of where to go.
Exactly. Yeah. Right now I'm doing counseling with someone who's going to become a Catholic this Easter Vigil. And it is I won't say her name to embarrass her, but it is the CNA, which is a certified nursing assistant, mm-hmm. who is taking care of my dad in the mornings.
Wow.
Who was a Baptist.
Wow.
And she came into the house and saw all the holy things. I mean, my house looks like a shrine. it's a very fashionable shrine, though. Okay? Very nice shrine. But it is a shrine. And beautiful, beautiful things all over the house to remind me wherever I turn.
Right.
That Jesus is with
watching
me
her,
and that Mary's my mother. I mean, everywhere in the house. And she came in and started seeing these things about a year ago and said she immediately felt called to become a Catholic when she walked into the house.
Wow.
Which to me is a message that we should also promote, that these things that we keep around the house are so important. And we have no conception of what they're doing to someone.
Yeah.
My father was being an absolute bear during the first part of his illness. He's now living with me. And he would give her trouble. Oh, boy, would he give her trouble. And she would sit quietly, she's a very quiet person, in his bedroom. And I had an icon of the resurrection, a big icon. And she said she would just stare at it. And it really spoke to her heart. So she came to me. So now, that's now I'm counseling her, and I totally forgot what I was talking about. But anyway, NYU. These things, yes, these things are very important to people. And I think I was surrounded by those things my whole life, so the effect never left.
Right.
So when I went to NYU, I was put in a special program for the smartest kids. Well, basically what it was a private program within the giant university for about 90 students. It was called the Metropolitan Leadership Program. And it might as well have been called like Satan's Schoolhouse. Because basically what they were teaching us was all this countercultural stuff. We didn't have grades. The teachers were very radical, very, very radical. I became a Marxist.
Wow.
I certainly didn't go to church anymore. I was not a mean, vehement Marxist. I still believed in Jesus, you know, but don't, you know how you're confused. People, anybody who has kids like this, you know, they're confused.
Yeah.
They don't understand. You know, they meet
someone. Oh, and your parents don't know because they're not in college. They didn't go to college.
They don't understand anything.
I'm in the smart class.
Exactly. They don't understand anything.
Yeah.
So you have a brilliant teacher who is, of course, playing right to your intellect.
Right.
No, and intellectually, he's brilliant. You're learning all these things. And so associated with that is this political stuff, so you buy it.
Yeah.
And I think we're in a time right now, which is very similar, where people buy it.
Yeah.
So you send your kids to secular schools, and they're being taught by people who are very radical, who are very anti-Catholic, and the kids buy it. Even if they're, so I could not have been given a better Catholic upbringing.
Yeah.
There's no
well,
way.
Well, and it's easier to sell it nowadays. It's well, much right. easier to sell it because not everybody has all of that around
exactly.
them.
Exactly. But what I want to encourage people with is no matter what your kids are exposed to, or these good Catholic people who've surrounded their kids with everything, no matter what the devil puts in their path, you still have formed your children.
Yeah.
You know, my father always said to me, by the time you were 12, you knew everything that I could teach you. So I didn't worry about you because I knew I had done my best. And whatever came your way, you were going to have to make choices.
But what about the like the people from my generation, just a little bit after you?
Mm-hmm.
We didn't get the good formation. We didn't get that solid formation. So how are we going to then pass it on to our kids? I mean, that's the hardest thing.
Well, I think that is very difficult, and I don't have an answer. I'm not the answer woman. But I think you do your best. You do your best, and you live the life that you know Jesus wants you to live. And I believe that that requires you to be a serious Catholic. Not a Sunday Catholic.
Right.
A serious Catholic. A menu Catholic, but a Catholic who obeys the magisterium and who goes to adoration and who sits quietly with the Lord and let yourself be filled with his love.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking serious here. We're talking about holiness.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you were called to be, is holy. And that's what you have, that's what you can do. You can become holy.
Well,
and your kids
you
are going to see it.
How did you come back? How did, after becoming a Marxist?
I'm telling you, I read the Little Red Book. I was a Marxist. I was a feminist. But as a feminist, I was always against abortion.
Wow.
So I would sit there with these women. I remember being up in the Bronx, and I would sit with these women and I would say, how can abortion be pro-woman?
Exactly.
It doesn't make any sense. The greatest thing that women can do is have a child. It's the only thing that we can do that no one else can do. So how can you tell me that ripping a baby out of your womb is pro-woman? It made no sense to me, and I was vehemently pro-life, even though I was collecting signatures for the Marxist group. I was confused, but the pro-life always stuck. So to put it all in a nutshell, I went along to medical school. It was, again, a secular medical school, but I always knew why I was a doctor, and it was a vocation. See, the word vocation.
Other people never heard that word.
No, the word vocation was part of my vocabulary.
Right.
I had been taught about vocation. So when I was six, I knew that was my vocation. And no matter how far I strayed, I knew it was my vocation, and that a vocation was from God.
Right.
And whenever I meet young people now in the ER, which is often, that's the way I talk to them. Your job is not to be what your parents want you to be, what you think you want to be, or what's making the most money. Your job is to sit with God, find out what He wants you to be, and go after it. That's where you'll find happiness and joy and peace and love and be what God wants you to be, no matter what. So vocation, the idea of vocation always stuck with me, and I always treated my patients with respect, and I always loved what I was doing. I never didn't love being a doctor. Fast forward, there was a marriage when I was 19. Okay, there was an annulment later. Oh, there was a lot of stuff, which we can go into some other time. But my mother, first my aunt got sick. I told you how important these women were to me. All of the women. There were two sisters, an aunt, and my mother, and a grandmother, and my mother. So there were four women. First my aunt got sick. She was 50 years old. She had cancer, and she died. Terrible, horrible pain. There, I was getting into all of this new agey stuff because I know I sound like I'm covering the whole book, but that's what happened. You know, everybody was into this stuff, and my patients would come and tell me they were going to energy healers and all this stuff and crystals and all this garbage. Yeah, right. So I said, and you know, Bernie Siegel and going to these seminars, I said, well, I'm going to explore what this is all about. So I went with my patients to a Bernie Siegel seminar in New York City, and I got deeply into that new agey kind of stuff. But at the same time, I said to myself, wait, this is what Jesus healed people. This does not make any sense. What are they talking about, energy? The energy is from Jesus. You see, I knew that.
Yeah.
No matter what, I knew that. So then my mother got cancer. I had come to Connecticut to be a doctor because I wanted to be near my parents in Rhode Island, who had moved back here after they retired. And in a nutshell, my mother got terrible cancer. The minute she got cancer, I clicked back to a woman who I had met years before at a funeral, a Catholic funeral, who told me about the healing ministry and these priests who prayed for healing. And I said, I have to call that woman. And so I called this woman in Long Island and, excuse me, and I got the name of Father Ed McDonough up in Boston, and I called him, and I took my mother there, and we went. My mother was a very regular Catholic, so we went up there, and of course there were all these charismatic people, and everybody's falling all over the floor when he starts praying with them, and my mother saying, "Go help them! Go help them!"
They're rolling.
So, I learned. You know, I began to learn, and as I watch, see this picture right here of the, I laid in my mother's arms as she was dying, and I knew that was one of the last times I was going to do it. And I prayed my first Divine Mercy Novena, and my mother died on Divine Mercy Sunday. And that was when the miracles began.
Oh, well, thank you so much for sharing this with us. Thank you for joining us today. We hope that you realize that a good foundation in faith for your children is so important, and that no matter what happens, they can always come back to the faith. Join us again next time.